Today is Wednesday, December the 15th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. China doubles down on funds for building chip supply chain. Well before the current chip supply chain crunch, Beijing had been trying to build out a local supply chain for semiconductors, its biggest import item. Tens of billions of dollars of government support later, China's chip processing ability is still at least a decade behind the most advanced players, and some of its semiconductor champions in the making are already faltering. On Friday, Tsinghua Unigroup, which began defaulting on its bonds a year ago, said it had accepted a bid from a consortium of state-backed investors to become its strategic investor, which will likely mean ceding control of key assets. China's finding out that spending lots of cash can't quickly build semiconductor self-reliance, especially as the United States doubles down on measures such as export blacklists that creates bottlenecks up and down the chip manufacturing chain. Last year, the U.S. placed China's largest chipmaker, SMIC, on the Commerce Department's entity list, which limits its access to U.S. components, including designs and software, after earlier doing the same to smartphone and telecom equipment maker Huawei, which crippled its chipset design unit. Two rounds of export control measures in 2019 and 2020 have prevented Chinese chipmakers, as well as global foundries that cooperate with Chinese firms, from accessing U.S.-made semiconductor production equipment and software. These blockades have seriously constrained China's ability to pursue technological advancement in the industry. China's Made in China 2025 industrial strategy set a goal of having the country supply 70% of its own chip needs by that year. To accelerate the development of the chip industry, China, in 2014, set up a state-backed $22 billion integrated circuit investment fund. In addition, many provincial governments established chip-focused funds. In 2020 alone, Chinese chip firms received around $35 billion investment. Tsinghua Unigroup, controlled by the prestigious Tsinghua University, was supposed to illustrate how generous subsidies and state determination would help China achieve self-reliance in semiconductors. But its efforts to use its deep pockets to acquire and invest in existing chip firms, which is how it broke into the industry in the first place, have been stymied by U.S. national security concerns, deepened in part by the Made in China 2025 plan. In 2015, a plan to buy a 15% stake in Western Digital was abandoned over news that the United States intended to examine the transaction for national security risk. Similarly, a $23 billion overture to U.S. chip giant Micron the same year also faced such concerns. Though it continued with other acquisitions, such as its $2.6 billion purchase of French smart chip component maker Linxens in 2018, the U.S. moved slow in its efforts to piggyback on leading companies with developed businesses. Then it began running out of money. Last November, it defaulted on $450 million bond, and by January it had defaulted or cross-defaulted on bonds worth $3.6 billion. The company had $31 billion in debt as of June 2020, but its cash and cash equivalents stood at only $8 billion in that period. The group over-leveraged its prestigious name and generous government support. Its subsidy fueled fast growth and failure to deliver the high promise of technological progress are emblematic of the major problems of China's semiconductor sector. A court-led bankruptcy restructuring process had begun in July at the request of one of its creditors. Tsinghua Unigroup isn't the only chipmaker facing financial difficulties. In February, Hongxin Semiconductor, based in Wuhan, began laying off workers just 4 years after it was founded with a plan to invest $19 billion. Meanwhile, the United States is considering tighter trade restrictions on SMIC to close loopholes that are allowing some U.S. components for chip making to still be sold to it. The company has gained strategic importance due to U.S. actions, securing a $2.2 billion in investments from two state chip funds last year. Despite these cautionary tales, money will still flow to the sector, which is drawing new players all the time. Heavy subsidies coupled with policy determination yielded good results for China's electric vehicle adoption. Chinese policy lender China Development Bank had raised around $30 billion for a new fund focusing on semiconductors. And certainly, heavy investment contributes to the United States' leading position in semiconductors. In 2018, it accounted for 60% of global semiconductor R&D of $65 billion. A major breakthrough in semiconductor chip design. Moore's Law, the principle that the number of transistors incorporated in a densely populated integrated circuit chip will approximately double every 2 years, is quickly nearing what are considered insurmountable barriers. Simply put, as more and more transistors are crammed into a finite area, engineers are running out of space. IBM and Samsung Electronics jointly announced a breakthrough in semiconductor design utilizing a new vertical transistor architecture that demonstrates a path to scaling beyond nanosheet and has a potential to reduce energy usage by 85% compared to a scaled thin field effect transistor. The global semiconductor shortage has highlighted the critical role of investment in chip research and development and the importance of chips in everything from computing to appliances to communication devices, transportation systems, and critical infrastructure. The two companies' semiconductor innovation was produced at the Albany Nanotech Complex in Albany, New York, where research scientists work in close collaboration with public and private sector partners to push the boundaries of logic scaling and semiconductor capabilities. This collaborative approach to innovation makes Albany Nanotech Complex a world-leading ecosystem for semiconductor research and creates a strong innovative pipeline, helping to address manufacturing demands and accelerate the growth of the global chip industry. The new vertical transistor breakthrough could help the semiconductor industry continue its relentless journey to deliver significant improvements, including potential device architecture that enables semiconductor device scaling to continue beyond nanosheet, cell phone batteries that could go over a week without being charged instead of days, energy-intensive processes such as crypto mining operations and data encryption could require significantly less energy and have a smaller carbon footprint, and continue expansion of Internet of Things and edge devices with lower energy needs, allowing them to operate in more diverse environments like ocean buoys, autonomous vehicles, and spacecraft. Dr. Mukesh Khare, Vice President of Hybrid Cloud and Systems at IBM Research, released the following statement. Today's technology announcement is about challenging the convention and rethinking how we continue to advance society and deliver new innovations that improve life, business, and reduce our environmental impact. Given the constraints the industry is currently facing along multiple fronts, IBM and Samsung are demonstrating our commitment to joint innovation in semiconductor design and a shared pursuit of what we call hard tech. Historically, transistors have been built to lie flat upon the surface of a semiconductor, with electric current flowing laterally or side to side through them. With new vertical transport field effect transistors, or VTFET, IBM and Samsung have successfully implemented transistors that are perpendicular to the surface of the chip with a vertical or up and down current flow. The VTFET process addresses many barriers to performance and limitations to extend Moore's law as chip designers attempt to pack more transistors into a fixed space. It also influences the contact points for the transistors, allowing for greater current flow with less wasted energy. Overall, the new design aims to deliver a 2x improvement in performance or an 85% reduction in energy used as compared to scaled FinFET alternatives. Recently, IBM announced a 2-nanometer chip technology breakthrough, which will allow a chip to fit up to 50 billion transistors in the space of a fingernail. VTFET innovation focuses on a whole new dimension, which offers a pathway to the continuation of Moore's law. Innovation at the Albany Nanotech Complex is often directed towards commercialization. And on that end of the chip lifecycle today, the companies also announced that Samsung will manufacture IBM chips at the 5-nanometer node. These chips are anticipated to be used in IBM's own server platforms. This follows the announcement in 2018 that Samsung would manufacture IBM's 7-nanometer chips, which became available in the IBM's Power 10 family of servers early this year. The IBM Telum processor, also revealed earlier this year, is similarly manufactured by Samsung using IBM's designs. IBM's legacy of semiconductor breakthroughs also include the first implementation of 7-nanometer and 5-nanometer process technologies, high-K metal gate technology, channel PsiGe transistors, single-cell DRAM, the Dennard scaling laws, chemically amplified photoresists, copper interconnect wiring, silicon on insulator technology, multi-core processors, embedded DRAM, and 3D chip stacking. Now we know how effective all that research and development money is producing. Last week, I reported that NVMe solid-state drives in certain configurations ran slower in Windows 11 than in Windows 10. An issue has been plaguing some Windows 11 users where NVMe drives might be running slower than expected, but Microsoft has now acknowledged the problem and issued a fix. As part of the latest Windows 11 monthly preview update, Microsoft is now testing a bug patch that should get rid of the issue. Initially released on November the 22nd, Microsoft mentions that KB500-7262 preview has a fix related to write operations. The company also mentioned that Windows 11 was performing unnecessary actions each time a write operation occurs. However, the issue only occurs when the NTFS USN journal is enabled. In most cases, this is always enabled on the C: drive, which is the primary system disk for most NVMe solid-state drives installed on a PC. If you want to get this update today to patch this issue, there's little risk in doing so. This monthly preview update was tested and verified by Microsoft before its release. Just go to Settings, Update and Security, Windows Update, then in the Optional Updates Available area, you'll find a link to download and install the KB500-7262 update. Download and installation should not take longer than a few minutes, and you'll also get some bonus features with this update, like a newly redesigned set of emojis. Verizon may have just enrolled you in a data collection scheme. The mobile carrier is reportedly gathering customers' contacts, app usage, and location information. Verizon customers who value their privacy should immediately opt out of the phone carrier's disturbing new data tracking service. Verizon Custom Experience is a program being pitched to users as a way for the company to personalize your communications with you and give you more relevant product and service recommendations and develop plans, services, and offers that are more appealing to you. However, this feature needs to see the websites you visit, the apps you use, your location, and the people you contact. If that wasn't enough, the custom experience program is opt-out, meaning Verizon automatically enrolls you without asking your permission. Verizon is signing people up without asking, and an example of how the program could benefit you, Verizon says it could present music listeners with a Verizon offer that includes music content or give you a choice related to concert in your Verizon Up Reward program, and the company then tries to persuade you with personalized content and marketing when opting into Custom Experience Plus. It's clear the primary goal of this program is to collect customer information at a level that is all too familiar for telecom companies. Verizon says it keeps data about the websites you visit for no more than 6 months and hold on to location and customer proprietary network information info for up to a year. Call records, including the times and duration of calls, are recorded. Fortunately, conversations and text messages are not used. Verizon said the following: "We do not share information that identifies you outside of Verizon as part of these programs other than with service providers who work for us. These service providers are required to use the information only for the purposes Verizon defines and not for their own or others' marketing or advertising purposes." Well, Verizon made this claim on their website. If you want to opt out of the program, it is a relatively simple process. You just need to log into your Verizon mobile account on the My Verizon app and enter the Settings tab, where you should see the option to leave the Custom Experience and Custom Experience Plus. You press Don't Use for both programs to keep Verizon's snooping eyes away from your data. While you're at it, you can toggle off More Data Sharing Options. From within the same settings where you opt out of Custom Experience, tap on the Reset button so Verizon stops using the web browsing and location data it already gathered as part of the program. What's troubling about the latest effort, how innocuous it might seem to Verizon subscribers? How many of the endless emails that you've received from your carrier have you read from top to bottom? I can only imagine how many people remain in this program, not because they want to be involved, because they had no idea it existed in the first place. While Verizon isn't selling this info to third parties, it's bad enough that your data is being collected by the largest telecom giant in the country. Intel warns chip shortage to worsen if U.S. bans imports of Compound. We have a chip shortage. It is in the manufacturing process of the different semiconductor chips. Well, that's the picture we read in the news. But it goes beyond the manufacturing process. Intel Corporation is railing against a proposed import ban on a key chip-making ingredient, saying the move would worsen an already perilous shortage of semiconductors. The company is trying to dissuade the U.S. International Trade Commission from halting imports of so-called chemical-mechanical planarization slurries that are sold under the name Optiplane. DuPont, Rome, and Haas unit makes the products in Taiwan and Japan, and they've drawn allegations that they infringe technology owned by Illinois-based CMC Materials, Inc. The ITC was scheduled to announce its final decision last week, but postponed it until later this week. It gave no reason for the one-week delay. Intel, the world's biggest chip maker, has told the commission that banning Optiplane slurries from U.S.-based semiconductor chip fabrication lines without a 24-month transition period could conflict with national security and economic interest. If the ban is approved, it could thrust an obscure legal battle into the spotlight. CMC's Cabot Microelectronics sought the move, saying Optiplane was using Cabot's cutting-edge technology for silica particles in a slurry for polishing the semiconductor layers. Cabot uses the composition for its ideal family of slurries. A trade judge in July said a component made overseas infringes Cabot's patent and rejected DuPont's argument that the patent is invalid. Semiconductors, which provide the brains and storage of most devices that have on-off switches, are made in a complex process that involves putting layers of conductive and insulating materials on disks of silicon. Circuit patterns are then burned onto them. That process, which takes months to complete, involves some layers that are only an atom thick and results in the cramming of billions of transistors onto postage stamp-sized pieces of silicon. The slurries are used at different steps in the manufacturing process, and subtle variations between them have outsized impacts in a fabrication environment. Intel looks to tap into concerns about the global shortage of semiconductors, which has hit a wide swath of the economy. The automotive industry alone is on course to lose more than $200 billion in sales because they can't build enough vehicles to meet demand. The ITC ban could hurt Intel more than some rivals because the Santa Clara, California-based company relies more heavily on U.S. facilities. Manufacturers from Asian factories wouldn't be affected by the change. But the ITC staff lawyers, which act as a third party in these cases on behalf of the public interest, have supported Intel's call for a 24-month delay in any import ban. That lag would provide a sufficient period for Intel to transition to acceptable non-infringing alternatives, particularly if the commission finds that there is a semiconductor chip shortage. An investigative attorney, Cabot, said Intel and DuPont are just using the chip shortage as an excuse to avoid an import ban. The reported semiconductor shortage is a result of a complex set of economic factors and has nothing at all to do with the supply of CMP slurries, let alone the supply of specific infringing products at issue in this investigation, Cabot said in its own filing with the agency. Well, the case is a matter of certain mechanical planarization slurries is now waiting for the outcome of the U.S. Internal Trade Commission ruling. You know, I have an Alexa Echo system, and it was something that I didn't know, that there is something else by Amazon named Alexa. I didn't even know about it. The voice assistant isn't shutting down, but Alexa Internet is shutting down. Long before Amazon would slap the Alexa name on the company's ever-growing number of speech-powered home assistants, the company's best-known product with that moniker was Alexa Internet, a web ranking service that was the go-to tool for early internet pioneers looking to get their sites to rank on search. It was considered a trailblazer back when Amazon acquired the service in 1999. But in 2021, the original Alexa is still up and kicking, the same way that a search engine like Yahoo is up and kicking. But that's more of a relic than anything else, and it won't be around much longer. Amazon announced last week it would be closing down the service on May 1st of next year, roughly 26 years after the company was first founded. Amazon didn't offer rationale behind the decision, choosing instead to keep the announcement short and sweet. 25 years ago, we founded Alexa Internet. After two decades of helping you find, reach, and convert your digital audience, we made the difficult decision to retire Alexa on May 1st, 2022. This was just released by Amazon with the additional words of thank you for making us your go-to resource for content research, competitive analysis, keyword research, and so much more. The announcement goes on to note that Alexa's already stopped offering new subscriptions and that anyone with existing subscriptions will keep on having access up until the shutdown on May 1st of next year. After that, the only thing those customers will be able to do is export their pre-existing traffic data off the platform. So if the data is important to you, start exporting.
Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. Backups, home versus business.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for us to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, technology, and the workplace, and how all of this impacts you or how you can be better at the workplace. Now, just recently, I was talking about offsite data storage, and a number of questions came out of that. How do you get people to back up? Who defines your cloud backups? How long is data held? How long till recovery? What happens if the service disappears? Now, in the business world, there are a number of things. So I'm going to approach all of this from the business side, and then I'm going to go on back in just a few minutes, and I'm going to talk about this from the personal side. How do you get people to back up? Many times, in many industries, the requirements for backup are set by auditors. They're set by industry standards. They're set by various regulators. So you go through and you see what requirements actually exist already. If there are already existing requirements, then you should work with those. Those are always going to be the best ones to deal with because they are going to be minimal. They are going to be ones that are set up and somebody says, hey, these are the things you've got to do. And I would use that as a guideline, as a starting point. Whenever I hear an auditor say, you need to do X, I do X times 2, whatever it is, I make sure that we go above and beyond. Why? Because there are many auditors, and those auditors may have differing opinions. One auditor may say you need to do it once a month. Another one may say you need to do it twice a month. I may say, you know what, let's be really good. Let's do it once a week. Now, who defines your cloud backups? Now, my approach is you back up everything. And you're going to back up everything in different ways, but it's a good practice to back up everything. In the case of cloud backups, yeah, that may be defined by the auditors, by regulations, and so forth. And same with the next question, how long is data held? As a matter of fact, in some industries, they say you only hold the data for 1 year and then you destroy the data at the end of a year. Okay, so you set up certain requirements. Now, the next one is a little bit trickier, though. How long until recovery? Now, this is usually a service side. This is how long is it going to take for XYZ company that stores your data offsite? How long is it going to be before they get that data back to you? And if you have to go to a full recovery, you want that data yesterday. It means your company burned down or something tragic and you're going to be dead in the water. The entire time everybody's waiting. So we don't want any pauses here. We don't want any delays. As a matter of fact, I worked for a company that we had set up a complete disaster recovery program. And I've talked about that before, but you know, maybe I'll talk about that sometime in the near future. But that gives you kind of an idea. And we had a lot of different things set up in this plan. What happens if the service disappears? Well, you find a new one. You find out if you have legal recourse against the other one because, yes, you're going to be spending money. But most of these services no longer disappear. So let's talk about the personal side. How do you get people to back up their personal data? I wish I knew. I've been preaching this for a very long time. And I will say that most people still are not doing as well as they should with backups. Who defines their cloud backups? You do. Yeah, as an individual, you define what is the important data and what is the not important data. I would say don't bother with backing up Windows. Don't bother with backing up the Office software itself or any software packages. But all of your data, everything that sits under My Documents, and you save everything under My Documents. Now, how long do you hold it? You can go my route. I have data that goes back 2 decades. I wasn't as good before, and yeah, I'm sure I've got some data from the 90s. I don't have all of it. I know that. but I keep it on hand everything I can because I know how important it is. I back up on a regular basis. Now, how long will it take me to recover? Well, I do keep two hard drives locally and another one offsite with a relative. And I will tell you that hopefully my recovery time is going to be, in reality, it's going to be about a day because I'm figuring it would be a completely crashed hard drive and I'm going to have to get a new hard drive and then I'm going to have to rebuild Windows and put all of the data from the backups on to the system. Now, what happens if the service disappears? Well, that's actually external hard drives. Now, I do keep key information over on a few different major services. I'll tell you, OneDrive is one of those services. Dropbox is another one. I do use a third one, which is more obscure. And I do that because I want to make sure that the data is solid. I want to make sure that it's not going anywhere. Now, if any of those services disappear, that's okay by me because I have redundancy built into my entire plan. And I think that is probably the biggest thing I can give you out of this. Do not rely on just one. There's a TV show that said, one is none, two is one. It basically says, yeah, prepare for one of your backup routes to go bad. I like that idea. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. How to guard against smishing attacks on your phone. Smishing? That's a new word. Smishing, which is S-M-I-S-H-I-N-G, is an attempt to collect logins and other sensitive information with a malicious text message, and it's on the rise. Among the many threats to your internet security is smishing, in which bad actors try to steal your data or money through a text message that attempts to trick you into following a link you shouldn't or revealing personal details or login information that should be kept private. The attack takes its name from phishing emails, that's F-I-S-H, for a response that leaves you vulnerable to various threats. But here the dangerous message arrives via SMS direct to your phone, which might make you more likely to fall for the scam. The damaging effects of smishing attacks can be serious and varied, whether they involve someone gaining access to your bank accounts or taking over your social media accounts. But if you know the warning signs to look out for and the preventive steps to take, you can avoid getting caught out. How smishing works. Smishing attempts traditionally arise via SMS text message, though they can pop up on any messaging platform, from WhatsApp to Instagram. They often come with a link attached that you're supposed to click on, or they might ask for a direct response, but you'll need to take some action to be affected by the attack. Just receiving the message won't cause any damage. The first kind of attack you'll come across is a link to a shady website, possibly one that's mocked up to look like a well-known company website or social media network. You'll be prompted to enter your username and password details. But rather than logging you into the site in question, whoever set up the fake site would take these details and use them for nefarious purposes. The second kind of attack would push you to download a dangerous app or run it on your web browser. The good news is that your phone will block a lot of malware apps automatically. It's particularly difficult to install a non-approved app on iPhones, but it's still something to look out for when messages come in. In the third version, you might get messages asking for personal or financial details directly, with prompts to reply to a text with your bank details, for example, or with login details for a certain website. As with the redirect to fraudulent websites, these details will go straight to the people behind the smishing attempt, who will most likely use them to try to steal money or information. There are some red flags to look out for. One is messages coming from numbers that don't seem correctly formatted or that contains unusual characters. These might be genuine messages from businesses or automated services, but there might also be smishing attempts, so proceed carefully. It's actually rare that any person or company will need to send you a message with a link embedded in it, so you can view such messages with suspicion. It's rarer still that these messages will appear out of nowhere, if they are authentic. They'll usually show up as you're trying to verify an account or making an inquiry or having an active conversation with someone. Another sign that gives away a lot of smishing messages is their sense of urgency. Many of them will ask you to act fast and impose some kind of time limit on a response so you are less likely to think about what you're doing. They might also try to entice you to follow a link by talking about something shocking or controversial that needs immediate attention, pretending that videos of you have leaked online, for instance. They might dangle a reward for responding, win a gift card. Or the message might masquerade as a warning, your account has been suspended. The bottom line is that smishers want you to take action. The security advice for guarding against smishing isn't much different from the advice for protecting your devices against any other kind of threat. Keep your phone software and web browser up to date is important and should ensure a lot of smishing attacks get blocked by the security features built into Android, iOS, Chrome, and Safari. As with phishing attacks, if you're in any doubt about the legitimacy of a message, get in touch with the supposed sender directly. If you receive a text purporting to come from your bank, for example, contact the bank through official channels rather than following the link that came through on the text. You should be able to quickly establish whether the message was genuine. Another piece of advice is to not rush into replying to a message or following a link. We're all used to operating our smartphones at top speed, sometimes without paying complete attention to what we're doing, which can lead to overlooking security threats. As we've said, a lot of smishing messages will encourage a speedy response, but don't take the bait. For the majority of smishing attacks, some quick and basic web research should tell you whether they're genuine. You'll be able to find out if your bank is texting you, or your streaming account has been locked, or a particular retailer is giving out gift cards. You can also try copying the text of your message into the search engine of your choice. If you've gotten a suspicious SMS, chances are other people have received it too, and you may find cautionary messages online. Data the FBI can get from social media messaging apps. Not every secure messaging app is safe as it would like us to think, and some are safer than others. A recently disclosed FBI training document shows how much access to the content of encrypted messages from secure messages services U.S. law enforcement can gain and what they can learn about your usage of the apps. The document, which I'm referring to as the FBI training document, details iMessages, Line, Signal, Telegram, Threema, Viber, WeChat, WhatsApp, and Wicca. All of them are messaging apps that promise end-to-end encryption for their users. The FBI document reveals what type of information law enforcement will be able to unearth from each of the listed services. iMessage is Apple's instant messaging service. It works across Macs, iPhones, and iPads. Because the messages are encrypted, the iMessage network is only usable by devices that know how to decrypt the messages. Then there's Line. Line is a freeware app for instant communications on electronic devices such as smartphones, tablets, and personal computers. Signal is a cross-platform centralized encrypted instant messaging service. Users can send one-to-one and group messages, which can include files, voice notes, images, and videos. Signal uses standard cellular telephone numbers as identifiers and secures all communications to other Signal users with end-to-end encryption. The apps include mechanism by which users can independently verify the identity of their contact and the integrity of the data channel. Then there's Telegram. Telegram is a freeware, cross-platform, cloud-based instant messaging system. The service also provides end-to-end encrypted video calling, VoIP, file sharing, and several other features. There are also two official Telegram web twin apps, WebK and WebZ, and numerous unofficial clients that make use of Telegram's protocol. Then there's Threema, T-H-R-E-E-M-A, is an end-to-end encrypted mobile messaging app. Unlike other apps, it doesn't require you to enter an email address or phone number to create an account. A user's contacts and messages are stored locally on each user's device instead of on the server. Likewise, your public keys reside on devices instead of the central servers. Viber, V-I-B-E-R, is a cross-platform messaging app that lets you send text messages and make phone and video calls. Viber's core features are secured with end-to-end encryption, calls, one-on-one messages, group messages, media sharing, and secondary devices. This means that encryption keys are stored on the clients themselves, and no one, not even Viber itself, has access to them. Then, my favorite one to talk about is WeChat. W-E-C-H-A-T is a Chinese multi-purpose instant messaging, social media, and mobile payment app. User activity on WeChat has been known to be analyzed, tracked, and shared with Chinese authority. The FBI has less access than Chinese authorities on this particular social media messaging app. Wickr, that's W-I-C-K-R, has developed several secure messaging apps based on different customer needs. Wickr Me, Wickr Pro, Wickr RAM, and Wickr Enterprise. The Wickr instant messaging apps allow users to exchange end-to-end encrypted and content-expiring messages, including photos, videos, and file attachments. Wickr was founded in 2012 and has since been acquired by Amazon Web Services. With all these messaging apps, the safest way, however, is to make sure the FBI doesn't consider you a person of interest. In those cases, even using a special encrypted device can pose some risk. When we say Big Brother's watching, this is not only just big tech, it's also the government and the hackers. So stay safe, stay alert, and be aware of what messages you get. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Facebook is faltering.
The website ComputerTalkRadio.com, ComputerTalkRadio.com. Marty Winston is joining me. He went off to some city called Mos Eisley to Chalmoon's Cantina. Actually, Marty, do you have any idea that Chalmoon's Cantina is the actual name for the cantina that's in Star Wars?
I didn't know. No, I hadn't been to the new Disney properties yet.
No, that's not even Disney property. Somewhere, it was the original Star Wars book, the novelization, actually named the cantina, and somebody had recorded that off on the internet. The strange things you find.
How do you know they didn't make it up?
I think George Lucas made it up.
Yeah.
One of the, I could have seen that on Facebook because that seems like a rather off the wall, just strange, mundane comment that would be typical of what's going on Facebook these days.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's like when they take your favorite show off the air and all they're showing you are reruns of something you never wanted to watch in the first place.
Yeah.
Facebook, maybe it's just me, but I think Facebook's lost its edge.
I am starting to think that. I know there are people that are on Facebook that are friends of mine. They are posting, but some of the things they're posting are no longer as interesting. Some people have just disappeared. I'm no longer looking at Facebook as much as I used to.
Yeah, me too. I went from like three times a day to three times a month. It's just, what's the draw? Why would I check in?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Although I have to say, I mean, shame on them. Whoever those Russian hackers are who send us those friend requests from young women in their 20s who claim to know us and be interested in us, have no work experience, no school experience, don't live anywhere, and are all dressed like you can skip the first three dates. And
that's an interesting way to put it, but
I mean, I'm just not. They're babies. I don't want to adopt. I mean, I've had my kids.
I've got grandkids that are older than that. So, getting back to Facebook itself, though, I mean, I think it's more than just okay. So, it's part of this is
now. Wait a minute. Facebook has always been dependent.
Yeah.
Very dependent on what gets posted there.
Yeah.
And if people who used to post interesting stuff aren't posting or been knocked off or people have forgotten how or they're so caught up in the morass of our dog died. It's a sad day for us. Or I just had the best chocolate sundae ever. Look, here's a picture.
here's 27 pictures of this one chocolate sundae. But I think so. I mean, we. Going into the last election season, without getting into the politics of it, I know that there was a lot of combative stuff and a lot of people that dropped off because of that. But then that was also being the people were going because there was politics, too. And
you know, a lot of it was engineered bot-sized content.
Yeah. And there's that problem, too. I'm wondering what do you think? Let me ask two things. What do you think is happening to Facebook over the long term? And actually, more likely, my second question is probably going to be where we're going to go anyway. So I'll ask this now. Is there anything that Facebook can do to recover?
Yes. In terms of where they're going, I think we've seen it on AOL and CompuServe in the past.
AO what?
When
CompuServe, you said? Yeah, no. And Prodigy. Don't forget Prodigy.
Oh, Prodigy and The Source.
The Source. Oh, man. And MySpace. You know, MySpace is actually still around. Well, AOL Mail is still around, but that's another story. But anyway,
hey, everybody. These are the original social media.
Yeah.
And they were a lot more like post a note at the general store and somebody will see it and drop their own.
Yes.
It's, right. That's what it was like. Facebook is really on the same model. And Facebook is, you tell me what you're doing. I'll tell you what I'm doing. Okay, fine. Don't do it.
Yeah. Don't send me another picture of anything caloric just because I need to lose weight. Yes.
I found a new place with chicken and here's a piece of meat in my mouth. You know, it's,
Yeah.
I barbecued on the grill. Isn't that a gorgeous hot dog? Well, you know, I've seen better. Look, can Facebook remedy this? The answer is not on its own.
Mm-hmm.
If Facebook has particular people in there who are very good at writing compelling content, at presenting things that intrigue others and pull them in, then Facebook can engage those people on some kind of a reward or compensation basis that encourages their additional participation. Any kind of a rainmaker for Facebook would be in its interest. Lacking that, if everything else is treading downhill, then everything is treading downhill.
So very similar to YouTube. A matter of
similar to broadcast television.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, thinking of the general people that are on there. You know, the popular people on YouTube, they've got a bunch of videos, and a lot of people, you know, they've got their, you know, their plaques with the gold YouTube logo. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. Facebook passing along their wealth, that's not a bad idea. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, the next year, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, January the 6th of next year, 2022. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, January the 7th of next year, 2022, at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, January 13th next year, 2022, at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, January the 14th, next year, 2022, at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is LIMAC, LIMAC.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, January the 27th, next year, 2022, at 6:45 p.m. Virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is bcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. With supply shortages, what is readily available as a suggestion for a practical computer-related gift is an external hard disk drive for backup. A new 1 terabyte hard disk unit can be purchased for under $40. For backup purposes, you don't need a solid-state drive. If there is an issue with budget, there are many hard disk drives available that were replaced with solid-state drives. You may have such a drive, or you may know of others that have a hard disk drive just gathering dust. An inexpensive external disk drive enclosure sells for $10 to $15. Be part of that 14% of computer users that are smart because they back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.